Keep your space feeling comfortable this summer with help from Menards. The Denali Air 6000 BTU window air conditioner has a 3-speed cooling system with remote control, allowing you to control the temperature of your space from anywhere in the room. You call the shots with auto and eco mode to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Stop by in-store or online at Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a cold, windy December night in 1926, hell was unleashed on a tenant farm near Farwell, the last Texas town before the New Mexico border. Thrown to the bottle in fits of rage, the burly man with the smiling blue eyes was in no mood to quarrel with his third wife over his bootleg whiskey and sexual abuse of his stepdaughter. He went from room to room in the house, killing his wife and each child with primitive cutting tools and his bare hands. By the time he concluded his bloody work, he had taken the lives of 9 family members, ranging in age from 2 to 41, committing what one local reporter called the blackest crime in the history of the West Texas Panhandle. Husband, father, uncle, embezzler, serial mass murderer, philanderer, child molester, convict and military deserter, George Jefferson Hassell was many things to many people, most of them bad. His pattern of familicide crime had begun in 1917 when he slaughtered his common-law wife and her 3 kids in Whittier, California. Later in Texas, he married his brother's wife and became stepfather to her 8 children. Using Hassell's confessions and his many interviews with reporters, as well as the trial transcripts and reminiscences of those who crossed paths with him in Texas, Oklahoma, and California, Mitchell P. Roth presents the first comprehensive account of the life and crimes of one of the least known multiple murderers in Texas, let alone American history. Roth situates Hassell's saga within the 1920s Texas criminal justice system, including the death penalty, which Hassell ultimately received from Old Sparky, the electric chair at Huntsville. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Man with the Killer Smile, The Life and Crimes of a Serial Mass Murderer, with my special guest, journalist and author and professor of criminal justice and criminology, Mitchell P. Roth. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks.
Thank you so much. First off, tell us how you came to be the author of this book.
Well, as it turns out, one of my favorite courses to teach has been on murder, serial homicide, and mass murder. And in my early years teaching, I had a young man come up to me after class and tell me that he was related to somebody that was the 5th white person to be electrocuted in Texas and had committed mass murder. And I don't think he really knew a whole lot about what he did, but it piqued my interest because I had never heard of this person and I consider myself an expert relatively on all the you know, major serial killers and mass murders. In any case, I asked him if he had any records or family documents, because a lot of people come up with these, you know, stories and can't document them. And it turns out he did. And he was kind enough to make a copy of what had been gathered by his family members who had gone up to the Panhandle in the 1980s, interviewed some of the last surviving jurors and witnesses, and, you know, basically had put it into this very short family manuscript. So anyway, I held on to it because I had a lot of other book projects going, and I kept telling myself, this is going to be my next book. This is going to be my next book. And I finally got to the point about 3 years ago, right before a COVID outbreak, that I had time to go up to the area that his family had been to and look for court transcripts and go to all the spots and start documenting it all for myself and going full throttle on writing this book. And as a result, I found a lot of interesting facts. I found a lot of interesting inaccuracies in the family manuscript. And as I went on and did further research, which entailed lots of newspapers from around the country, entailed, you know, even some pulp nonfiction, you know, detective magazines from the time period, as well as using archives in Austin, the Texas State Library, and in Huntsville, the Texas Prison Museum. So I was able to cobble together the story of a guy who didn't leave much of a paper trail. He was uneducated, but very smart, very cunning. And what we know about him, most of it comes from him. So whenever that happens, you need to go look at the ancestor record. You need to go try and, you know, find birth records, family records, and all of that. And apparently, there weren't many people in his family that were proud of him, and he kind of was lost to history. And I have a huge true crime library in my office at home and at school, and I've never come across his name, which I'm kind of surprised since he had 13 victims in total. And that's at least 13 when you consider, you know, other killers.
Now, let's talk about the early years, as you call it. He's the youngest of seven children, and his mother is Martha Jane Stovall, and his father is James William Hassell. So tell us where they resided and where their background was, and a little bit about what you could cobble together about his early life.
Well, the family, mostly his immediate family, was in the Fort Worth, southern Oklahoma area, just north of the Texas border. And he came from a long line of people that work pretty much agricultural jobs, farming and that sort of thing. And it went as far back as I could where I could find information and found probably the person that he probably got a lot of his traits from. It might have been a grandfather who had been a familiar presence in the court system in another part of Texas for arson and some other things, but nothing as nefarious as what he did. And, you know, the most interesting things I found was that almost every account of the story has his father being poisoned by a second wife and him deciding in his young teens to go and kill that family. And he admitted this was his first impulse to commit this type of crime, killing a whole family. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it turns out looking through Ancestry.com and other sites, the parents didn't die when he said they did. He wasn't out on his own as early as he said he was. And he didn't commit any murders before, as far as we know, I should say, his 1917 slaughter of his, you know, first family.
Mm-hmm. But you do talk and do have some substantiation of his earliest criminal career. So you talk about in 1907, he was indicted for embezzling $50 from his employers. Now, tell us about a little bit about his early criminal career and where he ends up and how much time does he do. Tell us about the results.
Well, he was working for a guy that had a gin mill up in the Fort Worth area named Sid Ross. And he became kind of a mentor. I'm sure he wouldn't want to be called a mentor after what happened with his life. But he, basically gave, you know, George Hassell, you know, advice, gave him a job, and unfortunately gave him some responsibility, which entailed, you know, going into a town to deliver, you know, some cotton and, you know, do some trading. And he had some money that he ended up, George claimed that he fell in with some bad hombres and they spent it all. And of course, that was the story of his life, deflecting his bad behavior on other people as well. But in any case, He ended up getting arrested for embezzlement. He was about 17 years old at the time and pushing 18. And he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. And what this meant at that time was serving this time in the different prison farm units in the Texas criminal justice system. And, you know, these have had, you know, terrible, justly terrible reputations over the years. And, you know, he documents some of the things that happened to him. I was very lucky in that I was able to find his records in the Texas State Library of what farms he worked on. And I was able to figure out what his tasks were. And, you know, when he talked about what he had to do, whether it was working on a turpentine farm or cutting sugar cane at these different places, you know, this was some of the information I could actually validate. But, you know, it was for very short periods at each, but enough to give you a taste of Texas justice.
You say that he was released in March 1909, and he saw a recruitment sign, men wanted. Tell us what he does, what decision he makes at that time.
Well, he was, like many of his ilk, he had poor impulse control, and he would often, you know, make decisions and then think about it later. And in this case, he thought about joining the military might be a good job. And he doesn't really go into a lot of detail, but apparently he joined and apparently he deserted several days later, as, you know, many people have done in the military. But, you know, he becomes a serial deserter, essentially.
You say that right after that, he goes and looks for a job. So he goes to who and asks for a job once again?
Well, he goes back to Sid Ross, thinking that, you know, perhaps that he'd done his penance and all of that. And Sid Ross actually gave him another chance, kind of a forgiving type of guy, it seems. Mm-hmm. And he helped set George up on his own farm with an agreement that they would split some of the profits. George also got married. He met a young lady. And what's interesting is during this time is Sid Ross, his employer, evidently, he knew the family of the woman that he married. And he also was familiar with George's sister, who was often kind of his only family member to give him any type of sage advice. And anyway, ultimately, George did everything he could to kind of make sure that this situation didn't work. And he ended up leaving to find a job somewhere else, leaving the farm. And eventually, as he claimed, leaving his wife and child, even though he claims there was an agreement for them to kind of separate and they would get back together once he found a job.
You write, though, that in truth, they saw his abusive nature and mother and child took off to their family. And meanwhile, the family had always thought he was either a freshly released con or just were suspicious of him in general and tried to dissuade their daughter from being with him in the first place.
Well, the interesting thing is that we know probably less about this wife than any of the other women that played a central role in his life. And anyway, he talks about her the most, that she was the love of his life and that, you know, they communicated by letter once a week and then she stopped writing and he blamed it all on the family that knew he had been recently released, ex-con, and didn't want him married to her. Well, in any case, you know, he acted like she left him and kind of hid out from him and, you know, really destroyed his ego and his life. And I bought into this, you know, not to get too far ahead on my research or whatever, but I bought into this until the very end. And I found a letter written 40 years after his death by his only biological son, by his wife. And, you know, in the letter, he had written to the Texas Department of Public Safety saying he wanted to get information on his father. He didn't know a lot about him. And so anyway, he said the reason they left was because they were afraid he was going to kill them. And this was right before I turned my manuscript in. And this kind of filled in a nice big gap there, showing that, you know, from the very beginning that he was a familicidal type of, individual.
Absolutely. After this, you write that he enlisted in the Navy in San Francisco under his real name. And because he feared his earlier desertion from the Army under his mom's maiden name, George Stovall, could be revealed through fingerprints. What happens as a result of this plan of his?
Well, he, as I said, he probably joined the Navy up in that area, because that's, you know, he was in California around this time and looking at, you know, where the bases were and all that. And he deserted shortly after that as well. And, you know, one of the problems with his desertion record is I couldn't find any of it in the military records, and I couldn't find it in any of the prison records, because he claimed he'd served time in Leavenworth and Mare Island in California and a couple other places. So the only thing I could go by was the years in which he really wasn't active doing anything else. And there was like a 3 or 4 year gap before World War One, or leading up to World War One, where he must have been either in jail or, you know, on the lam somewhere. But I do believe that he spent 2 years in succession of jails. I don't know which ones, but he, you know, he claimed he was in Virginia. He claims he was in California. And without those records, you know, you cannot substantiate it. But, you know, just from everything I've learned about him, this is what I assume, looking at a lot of different accounts.
Once he's released from prison, you write that he tries to reconcile with Minnie, and she was with her family in Texas. What happens with this attempt to reconcile? And what does he do afterwards?
Well, he claims that a couple of times he wanted to see his son, James Delbert. And, you know, so he would buy gifts and he wanted to, you know, come visit her and the family. And, you know, she finally let him, according to, you know, his accounts and others, see the kid, as long as he didn't share the fact that he was the father. And anyway, none of these visits went well. And, you know, he ended up kind of being ostracized from the family and just basically told to, you know, hit the road and don't come back. And after leaving the Fort Worth area, he claims that he ended up in San Angelo, Texas. And in San Angelo, he met a woman named Marie Vogel. I really doubt that this actually happened. I mean, it's a nice story, but in any case, she apparently had a boarding house and he sweet talked her, and pretty soon they're living together. And she had a biological child, and she was separated from her husband in San Diego. And so they agreed to hit the road and go to California and, you know, kind of start over together. One of the problems with this story is, you know, she's got this kid, and that reminds him also of one of his child. He's never mentioned as he's talking about his road trip and some of the things that he pulls along the way, where they, you know, try to pull these extortion schemes, luring men into the bedroom right when he's not there, and him coming upon them and, you know, demanding money to allow the person to leave. It just, you know, this Bunko scheme and all that, just, it doesn't sound right. I think what probably happened is he never met her in San Angelo, because there was no reason for her to be there. You know, she had no family or friends there, and that he probably met her when he went to California and got a job working on a ranch where she was working as kind of a caretaker maid and had her child there. That, you know, that's what I think happened. I mean, it's a great story, like most of his stories, but, you know, looking at, you know, whatever records I could find, there's nothing to substantiate that. I couldn't find her in any type of telephone directory or anything from that time period in San Angelo, Texas. And, you know, San Angelo was kind of the frontier. You know, what is she doing out there?
You write that she was born Marie Serlin. Her sister was Gertrude Hoffman, and she lived in Pittsburgh. She's a central character in this story as well. She said she knew him only as a ranch hand named Baker. So tell us what happens after with this relationship.
Well, he ends up on this ranch, living on it. It's a doctor's spread outside Whittier, California. And, you know, he's basically a ranch hand. And, you know, from what I can determine, she was working there as well. And her sister came to visit and was introduced to him. And it seemed they were the only two people on the ranch. You know, they were the caretakers, and in all probability were a couple by then. And, you know, he introduced himself as George G. Baker, and, you know, basically was trying to, of course, you know, hide his background. And one of the things they needed to do, since she was married, was to assume the facade of being a married couple with a child in order to be accepted there. In any case, they end up getting two other children as well that they supposedly got from an orphanage, claiming that they were for a rich person. And they ended up with these two other kids. And really, it's hard to tell how they got these two kids. Some Some accounts say the sister brought them to them. Others say that they got them through some type of orphanage arrangement. But in any case, by this time, about 1917, him and Marie and these three little kids, and they're all under the age of six, are living on this ranch. And the sister goes back home, back to the Pittsburgh area, and never sees her sister again. And George ends up telling people when she disappears and the kids disappear that they had moved on. She'd run off with another guy to Australia or San Francisco. And he continued to live on the property that they had, that they were renting in Whittier.
You write, though, that there was a next door neighbor, Mrs. Shanker, and her daughter, Myrtle. What did she notice and observe a few weeks before this disappearance?
Well, they had seen George digging under the house and in the driveway and that sort of thing. They didn't know exactly what he was doing. George would have an explanation later on, but, you know, basically removing dirt. And shortly after they noticed all this, the family had disappeared. And he continued to work under the house and live in the house. And they asked him, as they knew her a little bit, they would come over and visit with Marie and liked her very much. And questioned, well, where'd they go? You know, you would think they would say goodbye. And he said, oh, they just took off. And this becomes his mantra whenever there's a family disappearance throughout the rest of his life.
You write, though, that the next door neighbor is pretty persistent and reports her suspicions to a police officer. What happens as a result of that? She points to activity in this garage.
Right. Everything seemed kind of fishy to her. And she contacted the Whittier constable's office. And they sent over a guy named Bob Way over to the house. And he sounds like he just did pretty much a cursory inspection. But by this point, George had murdered the family and buried them under the house and did a very good job of it. He would say that to his dying day, that he did a great job, you know, getting rid of the bodies. And he couldn't come up with anything. He couldn't find the bodies or, you know, anything like that. And he still knew this family as George G. Baker. And this would become a problem later on when authorities are trying to, you know, find George Hassel in Whittier right at that time, which they would not find.
So you write that Gertrude, who continues and is persistent with police and continues to query them that what might have happened to her sister and the children. However, there was no report back from them of any progress in the investigation. And as you say, George G. Baker, as he's known, leaves town. And now he leaves with his real name, George Jefferson Hassel. He joins the Merchant Marines, as you say, and works in the oil fields based on your research in 1922 and 23. But on several occasions, you write that he visited his brother and his large family in Blair, Oklahoma, on a ranch between 1920 and 1924. Tell us about Tom, his brother, and his wife, Susan Ferguson, both 19 years old.
Well, Tom was his only brother, and apparently he was the closest sibling to him and his rather large family. And, you know, and since his brother and his family all lived on a farm and, you know, pretty much were very provincial folks and just stayed in one place, he would come back with all of these stories from California and the military. And no doubt he talked much about prison, but he, you know, was a favorite, especially among the adolescent and teenage girls in the brother's family. Mm-hmm. And he had, by this time, he had 8 children and, you know, and soon would be his wife, Susan, would be pregnant with another child. Well, in any case, for some reason, they allow one of the daughters to go to California with George on a trip. And this is around 1922 or so. And mm-hmm. She comes back, or she stays out there, and apparently she's pregnant. And George admits to having slept with her and, you know, didn't go into a lot of detail, but it was pretty obvious to understand this. And so she was going to stay in California and look for a husband, in his words. Again, she was still a minor, you know, when this was happening. And he goes back and, you know, to see the rest of the family. Again, he's very popular with them. He's a joker, always a smile on his face. I mean, he's a complete chameleon. He's everything that you want him to be when you want him to be it, essentially. And, you know, on these trips back home, you know, really nothing really happened of note except for the pregnancy. And he tried to, you know, pretend that he had nothing to do with it. And I think his sister-in-law, you know, believed that he had impregnated her and, you know, this was a long-running issue. And the brother, you know, seemed to be a down-to-earth, successful, hardworking guy. Apparently, he had some health problems at this time. And, you know, he was well-known in the community. And George was kind of a cipher, you know, when he came to visit. You know, he was just, kind of the brother that was there. And anyway, one day they're working in the a corral, by most accounts, and George claims that his brother was kicked by a mule and killed. And they were the only two in the corral at the time. And so everybody, you know, went by, you know, George's count. And, you know, if you look at the death certificate, it said he died from a hernia, some type of hernia. Mm. And it, you know, just it didn't sound quite right. And a lot of people suspected, you know, that it might not have gone down that way. But in any case, there are still others that suggested, you know, maybe there had been some hanky-panky between George and Tom's wife. Others suggested that maybe they got in a fight over him impregnating the daughter. We'll never know, you know, what the tension and story was, or if he really was killed by it was a mule, actually, killed by the mule. We right. really don't know that.
Yeah, you're right that it was a strangulated hernia, but she got a modest insurance policy payout, you say about $16,000 in 2020 terms of money. What happens, weirdly enough, and we mentioned it in the introduction, what happens shortly after between the two?
Well, he ends up marrying the brother's wife. You know, they take a biblical approach to this, taking over the brother's family. And she's what's called a Russellite, kind of like a Jehovah Witness. And they consulted the Bible together and thought that it would be okay if they married and he'd take over raising the eight children, and this was like 3 months after the brother was killed. And in Oklahoma, I'm sure there was a lot of whispers going on, and you know, they felt the best action would be to hit the road, you know, with the family and with the insurance payout, essentially.
And where did they go to December 1925?
Well, they end up, and you know, it's not real clear why they ended up there, but they went to Farwell, Texas, or just outside Farwell, Texas. And they end up becoming tenant farmers on a judge's land there. And they're only there for, you know, they're there for the next year. The kids are in school there. He's making his presence known in town. He's kind of a loud type of guy. He, you know, he's someone that makes his presence known right away. And I doubt this town had ever seen someone like George Jefferson Hassell. And the wife worked hard doing, you know, the chores that a plains woman would be doing. And apparently, you know, they did a good job, you know, keeping the property up and all of that. In fact, neighboring farmers said, you know, he did a much better job than would be expected. And really, any of his jobs in California, no one really knew him. Nobody could really speak to, you know, what kind of made him tick. And so, you know, all of it was that smile of his that was so disarming.
You're right. By the fall of 1926, that the couple is quarreling quite a bit. And he claims that she's always taking the side of the children. This is a 5-room house with 10 people. And you write that by December 26, 1926, he had amassed a respectable amount of property, including 13 head of cattle, 10 horses and mules, chickens, rabbits and hogs, and plenty of feed and farming equipment. Tell us what Mrs. Hamlin, the landlady, Judge Hamlin's wife, what does she notice on October of 1926 concerning the property?
Well, one of the first things she noticed was he had two of his kids building a kind of a storm cellar or some type of, you know, pit that he would claim would be for protection, you know, from storms and that sort of thing. Because they already had a root cellar for keeping things cold and all that in the ground. And she was always wondering why they needed to build another one. And then about trying to think, the family kind of disappears out of nowhere. And what led up to that was the fact that the wife and George have been quarreling. You know, this is the Prohibition era. She's very religious and Russellites don't allow alcohol in the house. And he always has a kind of a bit of an alcohol air to him. And he goes out in the barn and drinks whiskey from time to time. But I think even worse than that, he apparently had impregnated another one of her children, one of his former nieces.
Wow.
So now he's impregnated two nieces that are his stepkids. And you know, he really doesn't want to hear about it when he's going to bed, you know, that he has done this. And when he comes to bed and he has alcohol on his breath and she basically kind of chases him out of the room temporarily, you know, it kind of starts the tragedy rolling that would, you know, take place.
You write that the baby is sleeping with them. The two-year-old Sammy is with them in the bed. The children are divided up in the separate five rooms. The older son, Alton, is away working, I believe.
Right.
And so tell us what it seems happens that night, December 2nd, and why.
Well, it seems that night, as you noted in the prologue, you know, all hell was unleashed. He said he didn't remember doing it, but he picked up some type of ball peen hammer and started beating his wife with it once she told him for the last time, talked to him about the alcohol. And when the baby started crying, who was in bed with her, he killed her baby as well. And he finished it all up by strangling them. And so he decided at that point that, you know, he had to finish the job in his terms, and which would mean killing the rest of the kids. And so he went from room to room, killing them in their sleep. And until he got to two of the, you know, teenage, preteen boys who were hardy farm workers, and they gave him, you know, quite a fight. And he ended up having to get a shotgun, which was the only gun that was used in these killings, to kill one of them. But he strangled all the other kids, the really young ones, and he used razor blades. And, you know, it was a very personal type of killing spree. You know, it could have been done much easier with just a gun. And so anyway, he was worried that, you know, he knew he had to get rid of the bodies because his oldest son was supposed to come back the next day. Alton was about 21, and he was out on a work crew. And so he had to, you know, develop an alibi and all of this, explained that they had all gone off to Oklahoma, when in fact he had buried them all in the pit that he had dug. And the question, you know, remains, did he dig this pit ahead of time? Was this something that was pre-planned,
right,
or was it spontaneous? And I have a tendency to believe that it was pre-planned, since it was kind of similar to his first mass murder.
Now, he had to wait for Alton, and so he made preparations. Then Alton arrives to demonstrate this person's diabolical nature. What is the interaction that you write about with he and his son, Alton?
Well, George tells Alton that the family had gone up to Oklahoma, up to shallow water, and he would be following suit. You know, some of the explanations he gave is, you know, they weren't comfortable there anymore, or this or that. And Alton, you know, had a tendency to believe what his uncle said. And so they sat down, had dinner. George got him drunk, basically. They played some cards. Alton went to bed, and he didn't notice anything out of the ordinary in the house when he was there. And in the middle of the night, George went in and shot him almost point blank in the head with a shotgun. And he would later say he died the easiest of all of them, you know, which is pretty much true. But at that point, he'd wiped out, you know, the nine family members. Luckily, the first, you know, the girl that he had had a child with had moved to California, had stayed there and found a husband. So she was the one remaining member of that family. And nobody heard a thing. Nobody heard the shotgun or anything like that. And he got everybody buried. And interesting, you know, he, rather than flee right away, he figured, well, I stayed around the last time I buried the four bodies, and nobody found out, and I just stayed in the house. So he decided to do that here. But I think also there was a financial reason, too. He wanted to sell all the farm equipment and, you know, everything that he could. He found somebody to take over the lease from him. And, you know, one of the interesting things leading up to this is his landlady, Miss Hamlin, and noticed he had some scratches on his hands and on his face, and someone else had too. And this was after he had killed the family. And he told them he'd fallen off a horse into a stubble pile or stubble bush, and that's how he got them. But that was, it's the first story, you know, giving people, you know, reason to, you know, question, you know, his story about, well, did they actually leave? And also, why would he fill that cellar in when they just, you know, opened it, and, you know, he wasn't responsible for filling it. He was just a tenant farmer. So everybody kind of marveled at that. But he started advertising an auction that he was going to have of all of his equipment, all of his farm animals and everything. And the auction basically took place right over the graves of his family. And, you know, so, you know, over 150 people came to this. I mean, you know, there's not a whole lot to do on the High Plains. And these were times for, you know, families, husbands and wives to get together and talk and you know, share stories. So anyway, he sells almost everything. And, you know, really nobody's questioning anything except the women. There's several women, including Mrs. Hamlin, and they decide to go into the house, which was supposed to be off limits. And they find suitcases full of children's clothes and things that his wife would have taken with him when they were going up to, you know, their new home. And also she left behind all of her religious books. So they started, you know, really questioning this. Mrs. Ford, Mrs. Hamlin, they went to their husbands with their suspicions. And then the husbands took it further and went into town and talked to law enforcement.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. When it comes to therapy and psychiatry, getting the help you need has never been so simple. When you're able to access your provider from the comfort of your device, it means mental health care can be on your schedule. And alleviating the wait times to get an appointment or the travel time to an office can free up time for the rest of your life. Talkspace is so convenient and accessible, it helps me feel supported around the clock. Talkspace lets you send messages to your dedicated therapist in the Talkspace platform, so you can update them on the challenges and triumphs you're facing in real time. You don't have to wait for your next session. With Talkspace, you set goals with your therapist and they hold you accountable and make sure you're really progressing. Therapy can help you shift your perspective, find tools to cope in difficult times, and be a guiding light. Talkspace is mental health care that meets you wherever you are. It simplifies taking care of your therapy and psychiatry needs, because it eliminates the need to commute to appointments, miss time at work, or line up childcare in order to attend sessions. Plus, instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send text messages to your therapist and let them know the issues you're facing in real time. It's mental health care made easy. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace to match with a licensed therapist today. Go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code TRUEMURDER to get $100 off of your first month and show your support for the show. That's True Murder at Talkspace.com. Now, Mitchell, you were talking about that he has covered up his crimes, he believes, but there's a neighbor that has seen this trenches that he had built weeks before and noticed his suspicious behavior. And the women in there that are neighbors are also talking to people like their husbands, J.O. Ford, and other people in the community, and they go talk to the sheriff, as you had mentioned before the break. Tell us what happens with their investigation. Tell us how they proceed.
Well, when George comes into town occasionally, that's where the bank is and everything. And, you know, basically they want the sheriff and the district attorney for Palmer County, want him to come in and just to talk to them. And he really seems, you know, he's not that suspicious about what they want. Although anytime you're called into a sheriff's office, it, you know, you get kind of nervous. But he thought he'd covered all of his tracks pretty well. And so got to the point pretty quickly, you know, where'd your family go? And he went with his old story and he basically told them that, you know, that they could send a telegram to a certain person in shallow water that would say that the family got there safely. And so the attorney wanted to arrest George, but, you know, they both got their heads together, the sheriff, Sheriff Martin and the attorney, and decided, you know, they would just keep an eye on him as he went about his business. And he told the bank to let them know if he was withdrawing money or doing anything that might suggest he was ready to flee town. So they had an eye on him and their suspicions mounted and were finally, you know, confirmed when they got a telegram back from the person they sent it to saying that the family never got there, the family's not there. And Hassel, you know, didn't know that this was done, you know, at this point. And so in any case, he goes about his business, goes back home. He has dinner with the new lessees who are living with him, a husband and wife. And that night after meeting with all of the people in town, he was starting to, you know, feel the walls kind of collapsing on him, you know, that he might, you know, be in, you know, danger of, you know, being caught. And in the middle of the night, he yells out that, you know, for the guy who's leasing the house to come in his room, that he needs help. And he's got blood all over him. It turns out he'd stabbed himself a bunch. And he said, go get the sheriff and go get, you know, the doctor and so forth. And so it looked like his attempt to kill himself. He didn't say why or anything like that. And obviously, you know, as soon as this took place, people began to put two and two together, perhaps, you know, that he felt guilty or, you know, he just couldn't take it anymore. So they end up, the sheriff comes in there and with the help, and they take him to the sanitarium, the Baptist Sanitarium in Clovis, which isn't real far away. And they treat him and he survives all of this. But at the same time, everybody is convinced that the secret to where the family is, especially once they got the response that they hadn't reached it, that they were in the filled in cellar, root cellar. Mm-hmm. Right. And they get a group together. They unbury the bodies. They find it all out. And George, meanwhile, he's been treated at the hospital. He's in jail. He doesn't know the bodies had been found. And he doesn't know that someone did not support his contention that his family had reached where he said that they were going.
Right away, you write that the first discovery is the most horrific. It's the baby and a baby's arm and up to an elbow and a baby's hand. And so the gig is up. But he doesn't know. He's not aware that these discoveries have been made. And the sheriff wants to use a ruse with him to try to get him to confess potentially. So what happens as a result of this ruse?
Well, they go to, you know, the jail. And they go to, you know, the jail where he's, you know, recovering and basically tell him, you know, again, they go over his story and they say, well, you know, we got an answer back. Your family never reached there. And, you know, at this point, you know, he kind of gives up this subterfuge and, you know, kind of cops to what he did.
He gives the details, the horrific details of what he does in this confession, doesn't he?
Yes. He kind of relishes, in fact, repeating it over and over again.
Now, of course, the police, the sheriff is making arrangements, but also at the same time, they realize very, very quickly that maybe the story of his brother's accidental death, there might be something more to it.
Right. From the very beginning, you know, George claimed that he wasn't even in the vicinity when the brother was killed, that he was down in New Orleans waiting for a ship because, you know, a merchant marine ship. But he says this in quite a few interviews. But then you have the other side. There's lots of accounts that he was the only person there when this took place. And so, you know, he protests a little too, you know, strong, you know, in this situation. And people were wondering, did he kill the brother? You know, the fact that this seemed to validate a good possibility of that. And of course, it brings into question, well, if he killed the brother, who else did he kill? Because eventually they'll find out, you know, the first mass murder was in 1917. The second was in 1926. And, you know, those were his only murders. So it brings up a lot more questions as far as his, the death toll.
What's interesting, we didn't talk about how it comes that he confesses to the earlier murders of Marie and the three children. How does that come about? You write about it with Deputy Hawkins.
Yeah, he's in the Plainview jail, and you know they don't have him under a lot of security. Simply, he's, you know, badly injured. He'd stabbed himself in the stomach and arms and that sort of thing. But he called Deputy Hawkins in to tell him that, you know, basically there's, you know, since you know about this, well, this wasn't my first rodeo, essentially. And, you know, I'd killed a family of four 9 years earlier and the bodies have never been found. And, you know, most people thought, George was kind of a braggart that, you know, this was a bit of braggadocio on his part. And since this crime had never been reported. So they checked with the Whittier police and so forth, and they had no reports of a Hassel family missing. They had no reports of any people missing at all there. And, you know, and it's almost like he wanted to, you know, prove that, you know, he was, you know, much deadlier than they thought. And so he couldn't remember where the bodies in the house were. And so here we have him in jail and, you know, basically under his real name, Jefferson Hassel, George Jefferson Hassel. And they can't find any records of him ever living in the Whittier area. He was living under the name G. Baker at that time.
Right, right.
So anyway, a picture appears in the newspaper of him after his arrest. And he's in, I think the first picture of him was in his coal, working on the railroad tracks in the oil industry in California. And one of his ex-neighbors kind of noticed.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Give your home a beautiful makeover with flooring options from Menards. Update your room with flooring from Tarkett. From easy to install sheet vinyl, waterproof vinyl plank, to durable laminate flooring, Tarkett has the perfect style for you. Grovewood laminate flooring is stain, scratch, and dent resistant and designed with busy families in mind. Save big money on our wide variety of flooring options in store or on Menards.com for more great deals now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Wasn't that our neighbor? And here, 9 years later, he's being accused of committing a mass murder, and they're kind of putting it all together. And so anyway, they reach out to, you know, authorities and say, well, you know, we think this is who the person is. This is where he lived. Everything seemed fishy the way that family disappeared. And, you know, they couldn't find the bodies. The same cop that had gone out there in 1917, his last name was Way. I think his name was Bob Ray, Way. They still couldn't find it. So, you know, George didn't like to be called a liar. You know, that's the one thing. He didn't mind being called a pedophile, a murderer, but don't call me a liar.
Yeah.
And he drew a map when he was in the Walls unit by this time in Huntsville, and he drew a map where to find it. And they published it in the LA Times. In fact, it showed where it was. And ultimately, you know, he was able to, you know, lead them to the bodies pretty quickly and validate what happened.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we mentioned, and you write about all of the horrific details that he fills in for authorities, but he does not give up the details of the murder of Marie and the three kids. He refuses to do that, but promises that he will do that at a later date as the state is asking for the death penalty, and he believes that that might be his fate. Tell us about this seeking the death penalty and also his demeanor of everything that fascinatingly happens after he is indicted for this and is set to be executed.
Well, one of the things that comes up in the book, and maybe it slows the book down, is it talks about the appeals process because it took over a year to execute him after he'd been sentenced and he had to be resentenced and, you know, getting into a lot of the judicial mumbo jumbo. But, you know, he had no compunction about, you know, sharing the details of all his crimes with other prisoners and everybody else. And, you know, he wanted to make authorities wait until, he was basically in the chair before he'd reveal, all the information on what took place in Whittier. But I think the more they doubted him, the less he could wait, because he wanted that office. He, wanted them to say, well, he's telling the truth more than anything else. And so he gave it up, a lot earlier than he had planned to, where the bodies were buried.
You talk about alienists, the term for psychiatrists at that time, and then also interviews by reporters, prestigious reporters. What did they remark? And you chronicle some of the things that they saw and observed in speaking with him.
Well, the psychiatrists, first of all, psychiatry was, still kind of in its infancy, in terms of dealing with psychopathy and other types of mental illnesses. But they basically, once they spent a lot of time with him talking about it, they would often say afterwards, we have no better idea why he did it after speaking with him than we did before, because he could never explain why he did it or didn't want to explain why he did these crimes.
They tried to portray him as insane despite him confessing to these crimes and despite maybe the rules of insanity being new. What was made of this plea of insanity?
Well, the problem with it's more legal than a medical distinction, and it's very hard to, to prove even today, even though, it occasionally happens. But it was more his lawyer that wanted to, wanted this at first. George didn't want to say he was insane or anything, but he kind of went along with it as time went on. Once he was on death row in Huntsville, he realized, that his only chance of not being executed was to, claim insanity. And so, of course, this came up with the resentencing hearing and all of that. And it pretty much fell on deaf ears simply for the fact of, how much planning was entailed in this crime and the previous crime. And he was as sane as you could be, considering the ability to tell right from wrong. Because, the idea that he would kill himself, over the bodies being found, he knew that was wrong, and having, remembered that he had the bodies buried in Whittier. So psychiatric side of things, never really played out for him. And the thing is when you're sentenced to death, you're given an automatic 30 days, 90 days, to basically be observed by psychiatrists and everything. And one of the problems was they'd sent him from Plainview after he'd been sentenced back down to the death row in Huntsville, when in reality, he should have been kept up in Plainview until the appeals process played out. So he actually had two stints on death row, and one of them was shorter than the other. But he never really talked about being insane or anything. The only thing he could say is, he doesn't know why he did these acts.
You write about, as well, the trial itself that garnered the headlines throughout America and probably internationally as well at that time. Tell us about some of the highlights at this trial and your commentary, or one of the jurors' commentary, on the length of the trial, length of the jury process, and then the deliberations.
Well, there was dozens of witnesses, but the trial was, relatively quick for a death penalty trial. And the jurors basically pretty much came to a conclusion very quickly once they were set to make their decision. And they waited longer so that it would seem that they put more thought into it. But, it was pretty much to them an open and closed case. And they also wanted to, there was a lot of animosity. There was talk about lynch law and people coming in, breaking him out and hanging him and that sort of thing. Although, a lot of it was just bluster. And, they basically waited until most of the people were gone to, from the courtroom to give their, sentence again of death.
I found it interesting. I'd never read something quite like that, where the prosecutor gives his scathing indictment of George Hassell and the defense lawyer breaks out in tears and runs out of the courtroom till he can compose himself.
That was kind of wacky, because once the whole process went down, his defense attorney was nowhere to be found, and he was the one who was supposed to do the original appeals process, and so this kind of screwed that all up. But I think what bothered people the most, even more than the killings, was his sexual molestation of his nieces. Mm. And I think that bothered them the most, and this came out during the trial. It wasn't published in most of the newspapers, but it was in the court transcript. His confession, because he confessed to all of this. He basically distanced himself from the second pregnancy simply for the fact that she was, you know, between 13 and 15 years old, and he was trying to blame it on someone else who was on the scene at the time it supposedly took place. And in any case, this to most people was seen as the, you know, the worst part of the crime.
You write that he entertained journalists and other people, that he was granting interviews till just before the execution, right before. But they all commented on his demeanor. Again, you write about they weren't aware of psychopathy pathology, and so they weren't accustomed to it, and so they commented.
Yeah, I mean, they were very mystified later on when they, you know, kind of shared their interviews with other people about how someone could be so calm, how someone could talk so, how much they loved children, which is one of the things he was always saying. He just loved children. In fact, the first child that he killed reminded him of his biological child. And here's a person that could strangle them with, you know, no problem at all, and talk about it later on with absolutely no remorse. You know, people would say, you know, they would say, well, you know, sorry you did this, you're sorry you did that. But he, you know, there was no mea culpas, you know, forthcoming from him.
You posed the question in the epilogue that why are legions of criminals and murderers with much less blood on their hands? Why are they famous and this family annihilator is not?
Well, that's an interesting question. And if the thing is that, you know, you wonder why it hasn't garnered the attention of so many other crimes. And, you know, this was one of the, you know, questions that came up with, would anybody be interested in reading this book? Because it took place kind of in an area that really there's not a whole lot of the historical references about. But it took place out in the countryside in the 1920s, you know, basically, you know, as far as a small community, most of the people wanted to move beyond that. But no matter what, when you have a crime in that area, you know, it stays in kind of the DNA of the community for a very long time. And, you know, and basically, I think that's why other people have never heard about this, which is surprising. And it made me wonder, well, what other cases are there like this? Mm-hmm. You know, and so right now, as I'm looking at my next projects, you know, I'm trying to find cases that no one's ever written about, because, you know, how many books can you write about Bundy and Dahmer and, you know, sure, you know, the Hall of Fame of serial killers? Mm-hmm. And but I think the community just wanted to get beyond it because they didn't want to be marked by this crime. It's not great for Chamber of Commerce material. And so surprisingly, until recently, they were doing a play, a local play, a theater play based on the crime. And interesting, when I went up there to start my research, you know, I would go into different places, you know, I thought might be helpful. In fact, the hospital where he was treated, where he tried to kill himself, is an antique store now. And they had kept a lot of the hospital architecture still there. And I went in there and spoke to the gentleman who ran the place. And as soon as I said I wanted to talk about the George Hassel case, you know, he was ready to kick me out the door because people don't want to talk about it, you know. Yeah. You know, talk about a Nobel Prize winner or a, you know, prize winning cow or something, but not about a murderer. But I won his confidence, I will say, over time. And so anyway, so, you know, he shared a little bit of information, but, you know, all the witnesses from that time period are gone. And the only thing you have are family members that were involved, and you have their, you know, their stories about what happened. And, you know, and that was the whole idea of this, is to set the record straight and perhaps, you know, bring more attention, you know, to this type of crime, to this crime in the panhandle. And over time, over the fact, more recently, I found there's a lot more interest in this book up in the panhandle than there is anywhere else. You know, so, you know, I'm in talks with doing, you know, lectures and book signings and stuff up in, the, you know, up in the West Texas and panhandle.
It's interesting. You write about the memorial, basically the historical cemetery plots in 2018. Just tell us before I let you go about that.
Well, you know, because of the weather and planes and the winds and everything, the original tombstone was very, very weathered and was falling apart. And, you know, basically this might have shown too that there were, you know, a lack of interest or, you know, a lack of interest of, you know, remembering this particular type of crime. And anyway, a historical group got together, and, you know, one of the people that I dedicated the book to, a woman named Teresa Ann Sierra, and she's been, you know, one of the facilitators for, you know, making the cemetery look a lot better, you know, cleaning it up and getting with others in the historical associations a new tombstone. And so she gave me a tour, showed me where, you know, this person was buried that was, you know, tangential to the crime. And it was hard to find this cemetery unless you had local knowledge, but it's brought, you know, more attention to it. And there's been some findings, you know, of other graves that people didn't know existed there. You know, I'm hoping maybe this book will bring more attention, you know, to the cemetery as a historical place.
Right.
And in any case, they have a, you know, beautiful gravestone there that was donated, as well as all the help to clean the cemetery.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Mitchell P. Roth, for coming on and talking about your book, Man with the Killer Smile, The Life and Crimes of a Serial Mass Murderer. For those that might want to take a look at your work, do you do any social media? Tell us about that.
Well, I'm in the process of putting a website together, but you know, most of the information on my work can be found just Googling my name or going on Amazon, which, you know, has descriptions of all of my books.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mitchell P. Roth. The Man with the Killer Smile, The Life and Crimes of a Serial Mass Murderer. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.